I'm very pleased to be speaking today, which is the 20th of October 2008, with Conrado Salas Cano. Did I pronounce that correctly, Conrado?
That's wonderful, thanks.
Great. And Conrado, I understand, worked at MIT for a while, and I'm going to get him to basically start off...
That would be Caltech.
Caltech,
Caltech,
there you go.
Caltech would be very angry with that comment.
So I'm glad I got that cleared up in the initial few seconds, because I tend to get these two places mixed up in my brain, not having ever been there. But so anyway, Conrado, could you sort of expand on that and straighten me out on those things? So
yeah,
so about...
absolutely. I went to Caltech. I did my bachelor's of science. I got it with honors in 1988 in physics. And then I took 2 years to figure things out and study things, unconventional things that interested me, like what's going on behind the scenes in the world and so forth. And it was when I attended the first future international conference on future energy by Tom Vallone in Washington, D.C., that I really discovered, to my pleasure, that some of these suppressed things that I enjoyed, especially pertaining to forms of what's called free energy, the extraction of virtually free, abundant, and benign energy from space, were already being developed. And also, cold fusion, which I thought was buried. By then I was aware it wasn't buried.
Yeah.
But it was being actively pursued in some small, just a handful, a pocket of positions in the U.S. and around the world.
Mm.
And I could actually pursue, you know, some work on that and get a graduate degree on that, so I decided to go ahead and do just that.
Fantastic.
Yeah, and that's how I met Professor John Dash, a very venerable old man, one of those really good persons that, you know, in addition to being a very studious scientist who knows what he's doing experimentally. So I did my master's under his guidance, and successfully, I'm happy to say, I did a cold fusion experiment, and, well, two of them, and
right.
They worked. You know, they released the excess heat just like
right.
so many others reported,
right.
And there were new elements that were not there before, which was evidence that nuclear transmutation had happened, and we, you know, I was happy to do a thesis on that to add up to the very surmounting pile of evidence, you know, adding more fire
to the pyre. Right, yeah, absolutely, and just sort of a couple of questions came into my mind there. So I guess you must have been... Were you the only person at that time, you know, doing a master's with cold fusion experiments and cold fusion research, or was there anybody else there working with you that was, you know, doing a similar type of, project?
Under John Dash, when I was doing my master's, I was his only student. But then along came some high school students for the summer in a summer program, which I coached.
Mm-hmm.
And they actually ended up doing the experiments way faster than I did because... you know, they're more skilled with their hands and so forth. I coached them on the theory, so we made a good team. Dash had worked with several other students before, and some of them had finished their thesis, and I had the chance to study some of them. And my big inspiration was John Warner. Well, actually, I'm lying. John Warner was also working under Dash, but he was finishing his PhD. So I think, in fact, he was the first PhD to be granted on cold fusion.
Wow.
Yeah, and Warner ended up getting a job at Los Alamos, which was quite remarkable given the kind of field work he had done. And I'm really glad to have met John Warner. He really gave me good sound advice and everything. And there were a few more students at that point around the nation. Now probably there are more in the U.S. and then, of course, around the world. who are working on this, and because some professors are, like George Miley at University of Illinois, at Urbana, and a bunch of others, and you know, this thing now is growing, so it's always comfortable.
Mm. I mean, I was interested there that you mentioned one of the people that ended up at Los Alamos.
Yes.
And although at the time, you know, I guess you said it didn't seem very likely that that would happen or it was very unusual, to me, you know, these days that would make a lot of sense because, you know, with the connection there to the weapons technology and the black projects, I mean, would you say that was perhaps part of the factoring, you know?
Well, he managed to get into Los Alamos, not thanks to his cold fusion PhD work. This is only, of course, a very, very, very personal opinion of mine,
okay.
And I would be endangered, you know, to make something out of it. But my impression was that he succeeded in his job interview despite the sensitive nature of his PhD work. And as a matter of fact, he was congratulated. He told me that much. He was congratulated by having tiptoed his way around the political minefield of the subject because he really wanted a good job at Los Alamos.
Okay.
And my understanding is, you know, I lost contact with him, but my understanding was that he entered doing a position very unrelated to cold fusion, doing mostly security protocols and stuff.
Oh,
like
right,
that.
Okay.
Right. I don't know what would be of him. I wish him the best, but I just haven't been in touch with him.
Oh, sure. Well, that's a good background that you've given us there, a lot of information. One of the points I'd just like to pick up on was, you mentioned the idea of transmutation. Now, I know what transmutation is, but if you could explain that sort of what it actually means and why that is one of the key no-nos to many people who would dismiss cold fusion. They say that transmutation is just not possible. I mean, so can you address what it is and why a lot of scientists say that, you know, it's not possible?
Well, it should really be one of the yes for people to accept, because if there is unflinching evidence that the nuclear process has taken place, it's precisely that, transmutation. But it's so shocking to see that elements have been transmuted in those conditions where, according to some paradigms of chemistry and conventional nuclear science, it shouldn't happen, that many scientists reject the idea out of hand.
Yeah.
And will not look at the evidence properly, or they will tend to say that it was due to contamination and so forth. But it seems it's not due to contamination. Mm-hmm. I mean, I, for example, in my little experiment, we did it with a scanning electron microscopy, and the peaks were quite clear and well above background. And
wow.
Others have found, you know, many more elements and many more conditions. And obviously, according to standard conventional nuclear physics, the only way you can get two atomic nuclei fused, thereby a heavier element being formed, is via very high temperatures, such as those found in the interior of the stars, like millions of degrees centigrade or Kelvin, or those proposed for the huge, humongous, mega zillion dollar consuming tokamak fusion confinement project.
Yes.
Which have not been very successful thus far. And when this happens at room temperature, or at, say, you know, 1,000 degrees, which is cold compared to the interior of the stars, well, then people are obviously shocked, and many interests are threatened, you know, that it can be done so easily.
Yes.
And, you know, obviously there are many questions. I mean, we know that something has happened, but we only know it has happened. We don't know why and in what form. And none of the proposed reactions of conventional nuclear physics can account for this. And some of the objections were, well, there is heat and there are elements, but the heat is not commensurate with the elements. And if there are elements, where is the radiation? And blah, and on it goes.
Yeah.
So people had to counter that with some appreciation of the possible new theories that could be there. And now, for example, it is known that that cold fusion might be an ideal form of energy because the excess energy is giving off almost entirely as heat. Yeah. Or something that will be interesting to us later on in this discussion, which is phonons. In other words, sound oscillations within the solid state.
I'd heard of phonons, but...
Phonons are, of course, very related to magnons and plasmoids and things like that that we'll get into later in this talk.
That's very interesting. So phonons, to me, I was thinking they were to do with light phenomena, not sound, so I had it completely wrong.
Right. Well, phonons are really sounds, but, you know, it's only things I've heard, phonons, solitons, but it's mostly solid state, and the theory is very complicated. But it's kind of there. Now, one thing has to be said. I mean, people are shocked at the idea of nuclear transmutation at room temperature. It's not so shocking. Even conventional physics predicts it can happen. As a matter of fact, radioactive decay is just that. The only problem is that it was thought that that's just the decay of heavy elements, say, on the uranium, thorium side and so forth. But like our researcher Hideo Kojima in our lab has shown, it can happen for lighter elements, provided there are neutrons in the environment, which is something people hadn't thought of.
Yes.
There are neutrons, free neutrons there everywhere, and provided some of them are absorbed at some rate, that's going to trigger a transmutation.
Yes.
So, and that's a very gentle, non-intrusive, non-high energy input way of triggering a nuclear transmutation right there.
Yes, I mean, with cold fusion, you've got a certain density of material, haven't you? And in fact, there's a, I'm trying to remember the name for it. It's something to do with mass, you know, in relation to cold fusion. It's called high density mass or something. I can't remember the exact.
People work with what's called the power densities that can be reached, and they're not very high. In other words, it's true cold fusion. I mean, you're not going to get, you know, power for a whole nation out of just, you know, it's something in the small units. But precisely because of that, it would be very convenient for, say, homes or automobiles or delocalized distribution once the engineering problems were surmounted, of course, and provided the effect scales up, which is not that clear thus far.
Yeah.
Mostly it's a surface phenomenon. In my case, it was important that the palladium cathode was exposed because that's where the neutron absorption theoretically takes place, which is thought to be the trigger via electrolysis or whatever. In other cases, it's gas going through pellets or things like that. So there isn't a critical mass as in the atomic bomb.
Yes.
Wrongly called atomic bomb. It should be nuclear bomb, but whatever.
Yes,
it's not that you need that to go off. I mean, you can start with a small amount, but you do need an active cathode or catalyst, and, you know, platinum is not that inexpensive. It is expensive, so... But, you know, compared to the other expenses of the fusion tokamak, we're talking peanuts here.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think that you know, that's really interesting how you've got, obviously, all that knowledge and experience. And from the limited amount that I've read on cold fusion, you know, I can
Well, you're very well read. I mean, you're very, you know, one of those few people who are well read on this. Most people are blissfully ignorant of this.
Thanks
to our wonderful media and so forth.
Oh, absolutely. And I think, you know, I think one of the themes there which I was thinking is that, which ties up with a lot of the other stuff, you know, that we like to talk about and we're going to talk about, you know, you can see the cold fusion effect. You can see, you know, you can see that you get certain products like the transmuted materials. You can measure them.
Right.
But because you don't have an explanation for them, which, you know, fits into any current model or any current model very well, the rest of the peer review group will say, well, you can't explain it, so it's probably just contamination, or you just messed it up, or, you know, and it's not a real effect. And that, I think, is a common theme in many areas of research, that if you can't explain it, it's probably not real, you know.
Right.
And of course, this is just, it's just nonsense. Because if you know the way
Oh,
that
absolutely.
yeah, that's right. A lot of the human body, the way that the human body works in many areas, is just not understood. But you can't say it doesn't work. You know,
Of course.
it's not
This
real.
is called psychological bias, and it's really the wall that stands in the way of a scientific revolution, as Thomas Kuhn explained. In other words, when new discoveries don't fit into theoretical conceptions, or rather underlying psychological and cultural and philosophical and societal biases of the leading, generally elderly researchers and mind-forming persons of an era, then there is a strong bias to reject those new announcements of phenomena and dismiss them out of hand, or simply demand for their acceptance a standard of evidence which is way higher than the standard that is normally required for conventional fields.
That's right, and I think they have this statement. It might have been in Eugene Mallow's book, but I've seen it elsewhere. Extraordinary claims requires extraordinary evidence.
That's the famous phrase by Carl Sagan, and my good old friend, I hope he still can consider me a friend, Brian O'Leary, has a great answer to that. He says, no, it's not true. Extraordinary claims don't require extraordinary evidence. Extraordinary claims require extraordinary investigation.
Exactly, yes. I think Stephen Greer stole that phrase as well. I
Yeah,
was going to
something
attribute it
like
to, yeah,
that. And of course,
absolutely.
this is great because whenever the skeptics throw up Carl Sagan, I love to counter them with Brian O'Leary, who, after all, worked with Carl Sagan at Cornell. You know, I was trained to go to Mars. You know, and they look, but that's a different conversation. So,
Sure.
yeah, but yeah, that's the problem. So it applies to this area very much. So you have to counter that and say, no, please don't demand an absurdly higher level of evidence. Just settle for what's normal.
That's right. Well, I think if we move on a little bit then, we're gonna dive off into another area which I know you're interested in, and I'm interested in too, because
Sure.
you sent me this wonderful paper, which took me quite a long time to read.
Oh yeah, that was a long one.
The Sea Level Rises: Myths and Science, which I thought was
Yes.
absolutely wonderful. I posted it on the website and checked the
Oh, I'm
evidence.
proud of it. It was my masterpiece, yes.
It definitely was,
I
and
got a kick out of it.
it was,
The
and
fun
I
of it is, I'll tell you, it was for a class paper. And
yeah.
so it was exhilarating. I got something off my chest, yes.
Yeah, and I mean that I think that has come through in the way you've written it. But what warmed my heart is to think that this sort of material had been circulated, among a group of academics. I don't know how large or small that circulation list was, but the fact that that was in, had gone round in the halls of academia, that gave me too a nice warm glow. So,
Well, it didn't go around. It was never published in any
no.
journal, of course. It was just a class paper. But my advisor, my professor, congratulated me for it, gave me a good A grade in the course, and ended up being my PhD advisor when I
Great.
left the program under John Dash on cold fusion, and I moved into this professor's program on global climate change.
Right.
Right. Of course, I did not. I never finished, or even started my PhD dissertation. Never led anywhere. But I spent a year sort of mired up in the mud of things that didn't lead anywhere, but were interesting because I could look at the methane emissions and consider aspects of global climate change. And see that this whole area of climate change is far more complex than people often think. I mean, there is more to it than just CO2, definitely more.
Yeah, I this is, I've felt this for a long time, from seeing a program, in fact, way back in my ordinary school years, and in the 80s, our geography teacher sort of said to us, well, you know, this now it's all to do with global warming, but when I was at school at your age, it was to do with the next ice age was about
the next ice age, exactly.
Yeah,
that's the same thing that this professor was telling us. In his time, it was, you know, the gloom and doom was the next ice age.
But it seems to have gone a lot further now, doesn't it? Because certainly, you know, I put on we have a local commercial radio station here, and we have several of them, and on at least one of them, possibly two, I'm hearing adverts for, you know, go onto this website and work out your carbon footprint for your business.
Right.
You know, and then we can tell you what changes need to be made to reduce.
I think it's to legislate.
Yeah, you know, that's right. And then, of course, this whole tax thing.
And tax, you dear.
Yeah, it's just, oh, man, it's just a total psychological operation. And all the environmental charities seem to have bought into it, you know, lock, stock and barrel, and they're all towing the line. And
that's sad, because it's true. The environmental movement, which has started as an agent of change, has now been so co-opted into this. It's disgusting. Yes.
Yeah, it is. It is. And I've had to like cancel my membership, you know, and write to these people, and you know, point out about the chemtrails and all this this stuff.
The
you
people
know,
and the green movement, especially, I would say the British green movement, would be well heeded to look at the example of one of their party founders, I understand, though that's a topic for another conversation.
But I think I'll just mention here that if people go onto the website and they want to look at Conrado's paper, it's really a very good read. It may take you a little while to work through all the detail, because there is a lot of detail.
Yeah, and a lot of it I don't remember anymore. I just wanted to show the many inconsistencies in what's called conventional science, and, you know.
Yeah, yeah. And so I think we'll go back sort of to towards the topic of cold fusion, because I wanted to ask you, because I don't think we'd really spoken about this specifically, but about Steve Nee Jones, and of course...
Steve Nee Jones, yes.
Can you tell me about him?
The gatekeeper.
Well, okay.
That's my appreciation, anyway.
Yeah. And were you aware of him when you were doing your...
Absolutely.
You know,
I was aware of him, you know. I am a firebrand. I'm a revolutionary. Let me tell you, some of the people at Caltech don't remember me fondly, and, you know, I cannot say I'm not proud of it. I was too outspoken, and I paid for it, certainly.
Okay.
I could have gone way farther in academia than I did, but I didn't want to play the game. So for a while, I did try to rekindle interest in Caltech on cold fusion, and I was in touch with Eugene Maloff to work on that, but nothing came out of it. And when I was reading for that, of course, I studied some of the work of Stephen Jones, and I saw that, you know, he obviously had found some relevant cold fusion findings, and he had publicized them in the proper channels, but it was obvious that he was doing a kind of containment job.
Yes.
In other words, he was sort of allocating to himself the cloak, the mantle of a speaker for a new field of science with all the seriousness of proper academia and everything done through the proper peer review channels, which Fleischmann and Pons didn't do, obviously. That was a mistake. Maybe not, but that's what they were accused of.
But
Stephen Jones had this seriousness and this credibility, but hey, when you looked at what he actually had found, yes, it was a cold fusion thing, but it was a small thing that really would not amount to anything practical. And that was the bottom line. I think this was an obvious psyops operation.
Right.
At that point, I thought that, you know, just implying the idea that, okay, there might be something to cold fusion, but it'll never amount to anything practical that you can put in your car or in your home.
I think, you know, my the phrase that comes to mind again here with that, how you just described that, is limited hangout.
Right. Yeah, that's, yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
And I understand that one of his main, I think this comes through in Maloff's book a bit, that Jones was really keen to debunk the excess heat claims.
He was keen on the excess heat?
No, he was keen to debunk those claims and say
there was
no excess heat.
Yeah, maybe there were neutrons, a bunch of gamma rays in there, but nothing that you could actually use.
Yeah, yeah.
Right,
so that's
just some dirty old scientific curiosity in a Utah lab.
Right, absolutely, and I think it's interesting to, you know to realize.
So
that
you're talking about Eugene Mallow's Fire from Ice, I suppose.
Yes, yes.
I haven't read that. Well, I never actually got to read
right.
that book, or did I? Well, I read about Stephen Jones, who is Senga's book, who was like the hottest debunker. I mean, I think that this man will be eating his words by now if he's still around.
Right.
You know, I respect him a lot, but, you know, some people just talk about things they don't know much about.
Yeah, yes, yeah, yeah. I mean, yeah, it's...
Or they know about that they have this huge prejudice that just shines through and blocks new ideas, so...
You can see this coming through in Mallow's book as if you read it as well.
I hope to get around to that. That's a classic. Mallow will be sorely missed.
He will, and I've got a couple of audios of him on the website, which he's very, very passionate about how Einstein was wrong about quite a number of things, and
he talks about I treasure some of the articles that he wrote. If I can comment on this, my personal impression is I think he was murdered because of his involvement and his bold support of free energy and cold fusion. That the burglary of his house was just the covered dirty back job. But, that's just a suspicion, no evidence whatsoever I can adduce for it.
Well, absolutely. And, again, we're into the regions of plausible deniability, aren't
right.
we? But
right.
it's interesting to note... so we've written, there's some articles posted on my website written by Russ Gerst and CB Brooklyn.
Whom I listened to the other day in the audio clip you sent me up
okay.
last. Yeah.
Yeah, very interesting.
I still don't know who that person might be and might be interesting, but,
let
him keep his privacy, we understand.
That's right. I mean, I do respect that much. And I accidentally posted his email address on the thing, so I had to delete that. But going back to Mallow, it was interesting to note that he was murdered in 2004. And I'm just wondering, if Mallow had learned of Jones's involvement in 9/11 truth issues,
maybe.
A year later, what Mallow would have done with that had he still been alive? Would he have just not made the connection, or would it have made somebody like Mallow investigate what Jones was doing?
Something obviously awry happened, I would think. But this is the territory of personal suspicion. I don't want to say believe. I do my best not to believe anything, and so not to give any fodder to a skeptic. But
absolutely. But I mean, what we can do is we can point out the sort of strange coincidences.
Right.
For example, as you've mentioned, Mallow was murdered in a burglary, and he was at his parents' house. And then it was about 2 years later, not quite 2 years later, I think, that Judy Wood's student, Michael Zabur.
Oh, yes.
He was murdered in a mugging that they, I don't think they ended up taking any money, or so it was very strange circumstances.
And I think that, can I mention the connection of this student to Mallow?
By all means, I was going to go on, but if you...
Remember you... hearing this from Judy Wood, and this really was shocking for me and moving. Mm. Turns out that this student of Judy Wood, who was interested, of course, in Judy Wood's nose prying into 9/11, his uncle had worked with Eugene Mallow. So, he said to Judy Wood, "I'll be back next term, if I recall correctly."
Yeah, next after the weekend, I think it was. I think it was in the middle
right,
of the semester,
right.
But,
he never came back because he was shot, I think. And was this the Virginia Tech massacre?
No, he was. That was a separate incident. The Virginia Tech massacre April. I think it was April 2007.
I think
Michael Zabur was murdered in about, I think it was...
2004.
No, Zabur was murdered in 2006. It's almost 2 years after Mallow, and then Virginia Tech was a year after that, just about, roughly. Yeah, so, what had actually happened was, at the time that this came about, Michael Zabur and Judy Wood were working on a little demonstration regarding the aluminium. Because Jones had claimed that aluminium was silvery at all temperatures in daylight conditions. He'd actually claimed this
That right. That okay.
And so Judy Wood had got a little experiment, and she's posted this on her website a couple of years ago now. Since she posted this, but Michael cooperated with her on that. It wasn't really an experiment; it was just a demonstration. You know, they weren't.
Right.
It wasn't something that hadn't been tested before, and they were just setting out to demonstrate that aluminium would glow if you heated it up enough. You know, it obviously would be molten as well, but it would glow. And Jones claimed that that aluminium did not glow at any temperature in daylight conditions. And of course, an educated nuclear physicist should not be making false statements like this.
If he knows about what he is talking about, right?
Exactly.
You know.
So that whole, you know, we have tried to document that as well as we can. But yeah, like you say, you know, much of it we can't actually prove. So
we perhaps we never will, but
yeah,
people
yeah.
should. I think people shouldn't wait for the proof to come out to begin to position themselves.
That's right. I totally agree. And the next question that I wanted to just mention was on the subject of like this. Maybe I'll get this wrong, but cold fusion is perhaps something that happens in the cold fusion process, or low energy nuclear reactions as it's sometimes called, is that some energy seems to come out of somewhere, you know, not necessarily from the current that's flowing in the electrical circuit for the electrolysis effect, or however you'd
right.
correctly describe that. It doesn't come from the heat in the water that's already there, or it doesn't come from cosmic ray, you know, impacts.
Right.
It comes from somewhere else, and this has been described as maybe zero point energy, and I'm wondering.
Okay, here's the distinction now. Now, cold fusion and zero point energy, I think generally are separate things.
Okay.
However, many suggest a connection and that there is a substantial overlap, and I would go farther. I think there is a substantial overlap, but I don't think it's necessary to invoke zero-point field to explain theoretically the results of many cold fusion experiments.
Okay.
For example, our researcher Hideo Kojima at Portland State really developed this pretty theory of absorbing neutrons that explain the results of cold fusion, the excess heat, and the new elements using just nuclear energy. In other words, the cold fusion energy that is released is just nuclear energy instead of coming out as gamma rays or explosively. It just comes out as clean, benign heat very conveniently.
Right.
Okay. Now, having said that, you know, I would say perhaps 70% of cold fusion, of the cold fusion real phenomena, you know, the ones that are reproduced at some point,
yes.
verified, 70% of them might be, you know, this unconventional and further form of nuclear energy involving coupling with the solid state and phonons and many-body physics, which we don't understand. That's why physicists never thought that fusion could happen at room temperature. They haven't considered the intricacies of solid state. Okay.
Okay.
But there might be there 30%, which involves tapping into the substratum of all matter an energy, which is the zero-point field energy that would permeate all of the space. And here is where we connect with free energy, because the experiments that claim to have produced free energy are now tend to be explained as extracting zero-point field energy. And I think that's the soundest overall explanation, though there might be others that will get
right.
to, like, electron and spin and so forth.
Okay.
So there's this vast area, but I think that the underlying trunk of matter and energy is the zero-point field energy. And if you study the works of Hal Puthoff, which I'm sure you'll be aware of,
yeah, I know of him, and I've seen bits and pieces, but I haven't studied any of his experiments or his papers in great detail. But yeah,
I've studied his technical papers. The math is often over my head, but I can follow the argument. And one of his papers is very great. And it's quite non-technical. It explains how the zero-point field energy might be that underlying ground, not just for all of free energy announcements, but also for all of metaphysics as well as psychic phenomena.
Yes.
In other words, it's all connected, and at the bottom, it's just a sub, you know, as Paula Violet would say, subquantum physics or interaction of this underlying matrix. And obviously, for people who don't understand, I mean, this sounds awfully a lot. If this sounds awfully a lot like the Force in the Star Wars, it's because it's exactly that. And, yeah. You know, and I would go, we can go on and talk about, you know, what George Lucas, you know, when and how, but that's a different conversation. Now,
I agree.
The important thing is, where does this zero-point field energy come from? Well, it comes. It's been predicted by conventional physics for a long time, because ever since Dirac derived the electron relativistic wave equation and so forth, it's been shown that so-called empty space is not empty, but it's full of this sea of bubbling particles and antiparticles, electrons and positrons just annihilating each other and popping in and out of existence so quickly they cannot be measured due to the uncertainty principle. Now, it was never thought that this energy could amount to anything practical until very recently. And now, when some of these experimenters on magnetic motors, homopolar generators like that Tom Ballone has compiled and many others, the Bedini motor that you sent an audio clip of recently, etc. Many of them are now popping up to my pleasure. The scientists who are open and honest enough to address them and not dismiss it, they say, okay, it might just be this tapping of this underlying zero-point field energy. So it's real and it's practical and it could solve our energy problems. Why? Well, because the underlying physics is quite clear. I mean, there is at this point no upper ceiling on how much energy there might be down there in this zero-point field energy. As far as we know, this deep well might be infinite in depth.
Yes, yes.
Now, how much we can extract from it, that might depend on our cleverness. And also, I would say, on our spiritual readiness to handle this boon, of course.
I totally agree, and this is.
I posted a short paper. You gladly uploaded it in the website that explains, you know, how you can integrate the frequency levels and even if, and the many cutoffs that have been proposed, and the ultimate truth. Some people say there might even be no cutoff, so this might be, as Eugene Malov said, infinite energy. But you know, even if there is a very low cutoff, like what this estimate of Feynman that the vacuum has over 10 million times the maximum energy that can be extracted from the complete annihilation of matter and antimatter of, say, a substance like water.
Yeah.
You know, even with this estimate, which is pretty conservative, you're talking about solving humanity's energy problems for centuries to come,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah, yes. Well, it takes us out of the zero-sum game, doesn't it? That
absolutely.
You know, we're all forced into at the moment. I mean, that's really interesting, that sort of area of research. And I think it's great that people like yourself have actually looked at some of the maths, and they've tried to, you know, use some of the current sort of theory that's on the table to, you know, to look into this this area. I think it's very important that there are people doing that, and willing to accept that it could indeed be possible to exploit it, because a lot of people just say, oh, it'll never be possible. But I think, like you mentioned there, we've got a fair range of examples now where this energy coming from somewhere, you know, and no obvious explanation where it's coming from. And we've even got some mechanical examples as well. I mean, I don't know if you've heard of James Griggs's hydrosonic pump, which is a purely
James
mechanical
apparatus. Right, the hydrosonic, right.
You know, And one of the
and
common
they charge clusters of cane shoulders. And
oh yes, yeah, that's right. Yeah,
there are many varieties of this.
Yes, and I think that one of the themes that Nick Cook identified, it just he put it in layman's terms, so I found it, you know, easy to get grasp, is when you start to oscillate things, you know, this, like the Nazi Bell experiment, that was spinning around at high speed, which of course is a form of oscillation, and the Mayer cell technology, which is an electrolytic process, but what he does is he oscillates the current at, I think, 20 kilohertz or something, whatever it is, I don't know the frequency, and it seems that when you do this oscillation, whether it's electrical or mechanical or with a magnetic field, this is when you seem to be able to tap in and get an energy outflow of some kind. I don't know if you agree with that.
The key to tap is what you're just pointing out, the wobble, making it oscillate, making it go around. In other words, accelerating the electron charge.
Yeah.
You have to break the inertial frame. You have to create a non-Lorentz accelerated frame. And that's when things begin to happen.
Yeah.
Now, why we still don't know? I mean, I'm just an amateur reading some of the works of serious scientists, open, honest scientists who have looked at this and know the mathematics, like Hauke-Hofer, Bernard Heisch, or Alfonso Rueda, and so forth. But even they are far from being able to understand how, for example, the Bedini motor I think Newman was kind of a crank or a fraud. It's, I don't know.
Right.
But, you know, the real thing, my work. And it does seem to involve accelerating, you know, spinning around the wheel.
Yes.
I think it's just way simpler than that. But we have been so indoctrinated from our childhood into thinking of physics as something way too difficult, mathematics was and everything, that we've been blinded from looking at the obvious, and that's why the people who seem to have success in this are people who have not had it much formalist schooling. And unfortunately, these people cannot speak the language of those who are in the peer-reviewed journals, and that is required for acceptance. So,
John Hutchinson is a classic example.
Exactly,
of that.
John Hutchinson is a prime example. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and we know he can actually explain quite well what he thinks is going on, but because he hasn't got a set of published papers, or even one published paper, then he's written off somebody who's scientifically
illiterate.
Yeah, and this is the way it works, and we know that the control structure is set up such that, you know,
it's set up and it runs itself.
You know, we go back to the olden times when, you know, we've got this expression of the unwashed, you know, because the high priestesses and the high priests, you know.
The ones who don't deserve the knowledge and the initiation, that's exactly what it is. I mean, let's face it, in academia, the brilliant students are inducted into these honor societies, which I find disgusting. And at some point, you know, I toyed with some of them because I was tempted by power, but I realize that even in its own terms, that's not something you want, but some people just buy themselves into it, and then the game is laid out, and the knowledge will be given to you so long as you play the game, and so forth. So.
Yeah. Okay, well, we'll move on a little bit, Conrado, and do stop me if we're running out of time or anything.
We can maybe go on for, say, a quarter of an hour more, and then leave the rest for another segment tomorrow, some other day.
Yeah, absolutely. I think tomorrow will be okay for me, so if that's okay for you, that'll be fine.
Right.
So I'd now like to turn to 9/11,
yes.
Which is how we came into contact with each other through Frank Ferguson. And I just wanted to sort of mention that Dr. Judy Wood's research, and I think it proves, you know, and you know I've been quite heavily involved with this, with Dr. Wood, you know, we're now pretty certain that a directed energy weapon of some type was used to destroy the World Trade Center complex in New York.
I can buy into that, yeah.
Yeah. But you know, I just wanted your general thoughts on this, and wondered how much of the evidence that Dr. Wood has posted, you know, and what had really... You know, what did it for you, and what made you think, this is pretty scary, but this looks correct.
Oh, yeah, it is scary.
Yeah, so if you just...
And
you know,
it's horrifying for the victims as well, you know. Yeah, it's horrifying. I was aware of that 9/11 was an inside job way before I, you know, met you or Judy Wood. But I only, because I had read, you know, I was in touch with all the conspiracy theorists. I mean, now, conspiracy theorist is one of those ugly buzzwords that are thrown to discredit those who have the common sense to figure out that, you know, evil humans tend to collude with each other, you know?
Yeah.
Okay, so I followed some of this alternative research, and obviously I saw the inconsistencies. At that point it was the standoff of the planes and the burnt and the passport that had survived the burning, and you know and everything. Okay, and the hijackers who turned up alive, and the debris in Shanksville that was never found, and the hole in the Pentagon that was too small for a plane, and on.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I knew that. I was aware of it. Now, obviously, it was an inside job. Now, how when I didn't know. Now, when I met you and Judy Wood, came into contact with your work for Frank Ferguson, this thing was taken to a second level. Because now, it wasn't just that it was an inside job. It was that it had been done probably using some perverted form of this free energy we have discussed, in other words, weaponizing this energy from the quantum flux in some way.
Yeah.
And Judy Wood really showed these scrupulously researched pictures in which very bizarre effects were shown, like toasted cars, upside-down cars, like one car upside-down, the next car okay, next car upside-down, and so forth. Paper that had survived where metal was gone. The bathtub that was there when the rest of the building was pulverized. I mean, I don't remember that much, but okay, that was something that was quite mind-boggling. And obviously the strongest argument of all. I mean, those towers went poof, as Judy Wood likes to say, and the term has to start, in 10 seconds, which is the time of free fall. Now, even if a conventional explosive had been placed, you know, to enhance the effect of the planes, if there were planes, that's another conversation, those towers, there's no way they could have come down in 10 seconds. That's free fall time. For free fall time to happen, there has to be no resistance of material there, right?
Yeah.
So what made them turn into dust, you know, so quickly? And on. So when Judy Wood had the audacity, and you pointed it out, to connect this with the work of John Hutchinson and show that these effects were so strikingly similar to what the inventor John Hutchinson has shown in his lab experiments at home. Now, he's confiscated lab home, courtesy of the Canadian government, I think. Then obviously you could add two and two together and say, okay, well, if this John Hutchinson is sneered by the professional upper S skeptics like James Ramey and so forth, blah 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 blah, as a clown, and you know, or a fake, you know, like Ace Baker says, that fakes the videos and whatever in his effects. But yet, he has been visited by the sinister type of Los Alamos, in my suspicion, married to a vampire called John Alexander, and others who have studied his work and inspected it, then what's going on? I mean, there is a double standard here, and this looks like the typical sort of very exotic, covered, unacknowledged black project that they want to keep out of public circulation, discredit all public interest in it, and keep it to the industrial military complex and weaponize it in secret. Now, it's not difficult to think that this could have been weaponized. Of course, it takes huge amount of brutality and insensitivity to deploy them 3,000 human beings.
Mm-hmm.
But knowing who controls this planet and for what end, it's not far-fetched to imagine. That's another conversation. So maybe it was used on 9/11. Now, the effects on the towers seem to point to that, yes. Now, how well it does look like directed energy was the most possible form, you know.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, again, we could list the evidence, but it's probably not worth doing that here because people can look at the website and find you know, the circular holes. But, yeah, so, yeah, you know, I totally agree with you, and it is very troubling that we have this situation, certainly at the moment, as things are, you know, if you go onto the internet forums, and people are saying, oh, John Hutchinson's a fraud, and yet, you know, no one denies that John Alexander visited John in 1983, and I've posted documents that someone sent to me, which they obtained under a Freedom of Information request.
Right.
You know, which show that he did indeed visit John Hutchinson, and of course, as we've seen on various videos clips, you know, on some of these sort of videos that are broadcast on the Sci-Fi Channel, John Alexander makes no secret that he did indeed go visit. You know, he doesn't try and hide it, but then, of course, he classifies it as PK phenomena, and he just waves his hand and says, what John Hutchinson doing is PK. But this, I mean, that in itself is bizarre, because here's a guy from the military claiming that psychokinesis, which most of the rest of the world think is just a parlor trick and does have no basis in reality. And just to dwell on that for a second, you know, I sent this message to Ace Baker, you know, saying that John Alexander, who was a colonel in the army,
I read your long thread,
you know, and I said this to Ace Baker, and Ace Baker's response was, send John Alexander to me and I'll explain to him how it's a fake. And I mean, it's just the most bizarre thing ever. I mean, here's Ace Baker, who's a you know, he's maybe a very good musician, and he's done a lot of work with video processing and such like, and I did indeed pay tribute to his Chopper 5 study, which is one of these bits studies of video fakery. But for him to come out and say that this colonel in the army, he could educate him about John Hutchinson when this person had spent 4 months working with John, I mean, is this a serious statement? You know, I mean,
yeah. Has Ace Baker spent a single evening at John Hutchinson?
Well, perhaps we'll just move on and maybe just.
I don't know. I mean, we may want to ask Ace Baker, don't we?
Well, you know, I think he's involved. I think these people know exactly.
I think so too. I
know,
think he's dirty.
I've posted
let's
as much.
Let's not have fear about this.
Yeah, you know, I've posted as much in the articles I've written. I try and stick with the evidence. You know, I try and, as Judy Wood does, I don't think I do it to her standard, but, you know, I try and gather the evidence and post a conclusion, even if it's unpopular, you know, and, you know, unfortunately, my career doesn't depend on it, so it's easy for me, you know, so, okay. Right, well, I think we can just ask a couple of little short physics questions here. Because these are ones that Frank had included, but I think it can be helpful to some people who might be listening to this. Why does a microwave oven heat water in a glass? I put in a glass there, but it should be in a glass.
Yeah.
But not a piece of paper next to it.
Of course, we know that the microwave works by, you know, jostling the molecule of the substance at a wavelength comparable to the length of the molecule.
Okay.
And so that's why we'll probably hit the water, but not a paper, and probably because the paper, well, if I recall correctly, the paper is made of, what, a polymer, right? So if it's a polymer, we're going to have a long chain of atoms there. So that molecule is going to be way longer than the effective wavelength of the microwave, whereas perhaps the microwave wavelength will be comparable to the nanometers of
I guess that's it, and I think it's a resonance effect of sorts, isn't it, that's taking place, which I think is, you know, going back to the oscillation that we're talking about before, you know, that also comes into play. You're exploiting a resonance effect, and Dr. Wood made this comparison with the Tacoma Narrows Bridge in one of her presentations.
Yeah, the Tacoma Bridge.
You know, and if you can sort of have some method of exploiting the resonant frequency of the material at a nuclear or even atomic level, then that is maybe what the technology does. to cause the destruction. That's certainly, you know, one of my ideas with it.
Yeah, but I think there is more to it because you are using the resonance, but the resonance is the trigger. I mean, it's the key that unlocks the vault to Alibaba's cave.
Right, yeah.
And then what's inside, you know, inside this deep well, you know, comes out. I suppose.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. I would tend to go along with that. Maybe you're breaking into the room, but then you get another crowd of people to come in and do the damage, you know. So you need these two elements of the weapon. Okay. This is perhaps a hard question to answer, and maybe we can only guess, but there has been some discussion that Judy Wood can't be right, because the heat energy required to make the towers vaporize, which is what she didn't say anyway, would be too high, and we've heard this calculation of 75 terawatts, or 5 times the total energy output of the Earth, would be required. I mean, would you like to comment on this idea of heat energy and what would make...
Okay. I haven't done the calculation. I read the paper that you sent me, which really dotted the T's and crossed the... Well, it's the other way around. Crossed the T's, dotted the I's. Mm. By Kirk King, and he did a study, this destruction of the towers. Judy Wood does not claim that the towers were vaporized, just that they were dustified or pulverized, turning to dust. Now, the enthalpy, the energy required to do this, is much less than they're required to vaporize it. And it's related to the strength of the material and on and on. When you work out the numbers, you find out that the energy there, and this is what Kirk King did, is, and this is max of coefficient methodology because that might be exactly what was involved, is higher, like an order of magnitude higher or more, of what could be accounted for by any chemical form of explosive, like thermite, whatever. Mm. So something different was involved. Now, this Kirk King stops there on a cliffhanger and says, I'll leave it to you to figure out what. We don't know what, but obviously if it was not a chemical explosive, then it can only be either a nuclear explosive, which is the thesis of Stephen Jones, micronukes, right?
Yeah.
Or this exotic zero-point field form of energy.
Well, I mean, I just stop there, because micronukes wasn't suggested by Steve Jones. He sticks with the thermites.
I'm sorry.
It's Bill Deagle who's one of the micronukers and Ed Ward. But yeah.
Oh, that's right. Stephen Jones is thermite, isn't he?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So that you know, I totally agree with that, and that I also found Kirk King's paper very.
But no, I haven't worked out it once. But I think that even if you were to vaporize the towers in 10 seconds, I don't think you're going to exceed the output of the Earth. But you know, I haven't done the calculation, so I might be wrong. I don't know.
All right. Another one of the questions that Frank, I think, had wanted to ask a lot was along these lines of, you know, we've talked about how possibly it seems in some of the cold fusion experiments and some of the others that we're looking at, we've mentioned and touched on, the energy, you know, we're getting more energy out than we put in, or at some point in the experiment, energy seems to be coming from somewhere that it shouldn't be coming from by, you know, the sort of conventional way of looking at things. So is it possible that the energy which was used in destroying the towers actually came from within the material of the towers themselves?
It's possible. Again, if it was, for example, a form of perverted cold fusion, weaponized cold fusion, which has been suggested, by the way, and no wonder some experiments were done in Los Alamos on cold fusion, then the energy would be nuclear energy. It's stored in the nuclei of wood, iron in the steel, for example. Mm. Now, perhaps it was something different. Perhaps it was the zero-point field energy. If it was zero-point field energy, then it wasn't properly in the material, but in the underlying vacuum of space, which is not really empty, but just full of energy. And, you know, that's the paradigm breaking there. And you're not getting energy from nowhere. You're getting it from somewhere you haven't considered had energy before. Now, there is this other idea, which we'll go into, and this is that it might come from electron and spin. But how this might happen, I mean, conventionally, I don't see energy coming out of electron and spin the way Paula Viola suggests, but this electron and spin might be, again, a form of unlocking the underlying zero-point field energy, or it may be truly a source of new energy in itself, which hasn't been considered in conventional physics. And here I'm getting lost because my ignorance is vast and I don't know what's going on, but I try to keep an open mind. I don't know. But yeah, the energy could come from the material itself, could come from the vacuum, could come from electron spin. We don't know.
Yeah. I mean, that's more or less my position, that we can't really answer, you know, this question with any confidence, because we don't, I think really basically there are groups of people who know all about, they must know how the technology works because it was used. So they must know very clearly how it works, and they must have a control panel for it somewhere, you know.
Yeah, it's terrifying,
so
thought, isn't it?
It is. So I mean, these are the facts, and this is really the crunch central issue is that, you know, who was at the control panel of this thing, you know, and how was it developed in secret?
I don't know if we'll ever know in our generation. I hope so, but, well, you know, we still don't know who killed JFK, and look how many years have passed. And that was just one. In 9/11, there were 3,000.
Yeah. The next question that we had here was, were the clouds of smoke which passed over people on 9/11 who were escaping from the destruction of the towers, were they hot or were they cool?
It does look from the videos that Judy Wood has posted that these papers, these materials around the towers were cold, which is bizarre, because if you have a conventional explosion, you're going to get enthalpy release. You're going to get chaos. You're going to get disorder. You're going to get heat out of order. You know, that's conventional thermodynamics there, you know?
Yeah.
If things left to themselves, they tend to break apart, destroy, and mechanical work gets converted into heat, you know, and that's the collateral of explosions. Now, if the collateral is cold, we have a new paradigm here. We have, I think, what Tom Berden describes as the negentropic effect, something that violates the second law of thermodynamics is suggested here. I don't know of any explosive that leaves things colder than they were before.
This is the key, again, one of the key features of the destruction, which to me is easy to see. You know, we've got the videos. I mean, we've got a guy with a camera getting, you know, I've got it in the video that I made. It's a guy getting under a truck with his camera still running, and you see the cloud coming round him, you know, and all the camera picture goes foggy, and then it clears after a few seconds, a bit, not totally, and he gets up and he walks on. And I mean, if this was a hot cloud of nuclear material, or, you know, superheated material, it would be by a nuclear explosion, then that camera would not have survived, or it would have ceased functioning to actually continue running the film.
Right.
And the guy would have died, or he would have been badly burned.
Yeah.
You know, etc. So the evidence for heat is very, very slim on any large scale. I mean, there may have been isolated pockets of heat, and we have
reports. Sure, there were some fires, but they were minor.
Yeah, that's
and they seem not to really burn, because the rescue workers just seem to idly watch for them, right?
Yeah, that's right. We've got a couple of pictures of the fireman walking through this fire with his pant leg, his trouser leg, right next to it. And then we've got Patricia Ondrovich's testimony as well, where she's got cars exploding right next to her, you know, for no reason. I mean, why would cars explode even if the building had come down, for heaven's sake? You know, it had been blown to bits.
There was an electromagnetic disturbance, you know, blowing up a private car, you know, or something like that.
That's what it seems to be.
Right.
Okay, so we talked about the lack of heat a bit. We could talk a lot more about that. One of the things I just wanted to flip in was we talked about the transmutation in cold fusion, and this is something that John seems to have at least partly observed.
Okay, this looks now like we're opening a new cage of things here, of Pandora's box. Why don't we leave it for the second segment for tomorrow?
Okay. All right. Well, we'll resume at this point tomorrow, and I'll probably edit this together into...
Yeah, and see how it comes out and everything.
Yeah, absolutely.
Wonderful, Andrew. So are you going to be around tomorrow around same time?
So about 6 p.m.
What we'll do is, set it at your 6 p.m., which is 7 p.m. here, and today. And if there is a problem, I'll call you in advance or email you, let you know.
Yeah,
wonderful.
Great.
Thanks. This was lovely.
Yeah, great, Karan.
Wonderful.
Thanks very much. Yeah, you take care now. Have a good evening.